Good evening, and welcome to Open Forum. I am your host, Scott Sherman. I'm a pastor here at the City Church of San Francisco. Welcome. We're delighted you've come tonight. I guess I'll begin by asking you politely to please remember now to set your cell phones and pagers and beepers to stun. And the first of many Star Trek analogies I promise you this evening. Let me tell you a little bit about open forums. This is something we do here at City Church where we try to bring in artists, writers, musicians, leading thinkers to lecture, to perform, and then create a venue where we have an onstage conversation. But then, as well, create an opportunity for you, the audience, to interact with questions and answers with our guest. Our guest this evening is Professor Alistair McGrath of Oxford University. I'll say just a little more about him in a moment, but first let me explain what's going to happen. Again, we'll have a lecture, an onstage conversation, and then you'll have an opportunity to ask your questions. At the conclusion, there'll also be an opportunity, if you're interested in purchasing one of Dr. McGrath's books that is pertinent to tonight's lecture. One of his many books. This one is called Dawkins' God, Genes, Memes, and the Meaning of Life, published by Blackwell. We have copies. It's available for $16, and Dr. McGrath will be available afterwards for a book signing. Alistair McGrath is one of the most well-known theologians in the world. In 1995, he was appointed principal of Wycliffe Hall, Oxford, and in 2000, he was appointed to a personal chair in historical theology at Oxford University. 2 years ago, he began a new venture, the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. He's written many books on various subjects, Reformation theology, the future of Anglicanism, the future of evangelicalism, Christian apologetics, intellectual biographies, anthologies of Christian literature, and he has even threatened to write a detective novel. And I wanted to say on behalf, really, of the pastors here, Mike Hayes, Fred Harrell, and myself, that we're all devoted P.D. James fans, and she's about to retire, so get with it. We're looking for someone to fill her place. He's also written on the interface between faith and science. Before studying theology, he earned a doctorate at Oxford in molecular biophysics. And then he went on to earn a doctorate in theology. Now, it seems inevitable that those two would come together at some point, and specifically that he would eventually engage the thought of Richard Dawkins, which is central to tonight's lecture. Richard Dawkins is the Charles Simony Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University, a prominent scientist, and one of the world's, arguably the world's most preeminent atheist. His most recent book is entitled The God Delusion, in which he attempts to present the supreme improbability of a supreme being. And even more, that belief in God is a deadly delusion. He and Professor McGrath recently debated on the BBC, and Professor McGrath and his wife have already, in a month's time, written a response to the God delusion. You'll hear more tonight as he shares with us his response to this most important book. Please welcome Alistair McGrath.
Well, thank you very much, and it's very good to be with you tonight. And what I'm going to do is to outline some of the arguments we find in Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and try and make some kind of response to them. And it's a very interesting book. It's 400 pages long. And what I find myself wondering is this. Why is it necessary to write a 400-page book explaining that God is delusion if this is not actually self-evidently true? As you probably know, the background to this book is very, very intriguing. I grew up in Northern Ireland in the 1960s, and I was an atheist at that stage. It seemed to me self-evidently true that A, religion was dangerous, leading to violence, and B, it was on its way out. And certainly that was very much the mood of the 1960s. And those of you who are around then will remember that there were these very confident predictions that religion would be giving way to a secular phase in Western culture, that in effect religion was already on its way out, and that basically we were entering into almost something approaching a godless phase in Western culture. And as you will all know, it just hasn't worked out like that. And so we are seeing a number of very interesting books, in effect, putting a very strong, even strident atheist case. One might think of the writings of Daniel Dennett. We can think of others as well, Sam Harris. And Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, I would suspect probably is the most important of these books. And so what I want to do this evening is to try and identify some of the themes and make a response. Dawkins speaks at great length of the process of non-thinking that he calls faith. It's a very interesting soundbite. But is there actually a reality behind that soundbite? When I was young, I studied sciences. And in fact, I saw sciences right the way through from high school to a doctorate in molecular biophysics before changing to the study of theology. And in the process of studying the sciences, I moved from being an atheist to being a Christian. Richard Dawkins, apparently, did quite the opposite. He moved from being what I think must have been a very nominal Christian to being an atheist. How, I wonder, does Richard Dawkins account for my transition? A transition for which there are many, many parallels. How does he account for my movement from atheism to Christianity? As I read The God Delusion, I find that I have very few options in accounting for this. I must be an extremely stupid person. I must be a deluded person, or I must be an evil person. Really, there aren't very many other options. I'm not quite clear from reading Dawkins whether, because I have been infected by a very vicious God virus, I believe in God, or whether because I believe in God, I've been infected by a very vicious God virus. But anyway, that's the way things seem to be. And indeed, one of the many criticisms that's directed against Dawkins' book, especially in the United Kingdom, where, as you probably know, it's had a very poor press, is that it is so relentlessly negative about religion, so relentlessly negative about those who find religion helpful and even right, that really has to be asked whether this is a fair, objective encounter of any kind at all. As you may know, the British magazine Prospect voted Richard Dawkins one of the top three intellectuals of recent times. That point is mentioned quite prominently in the book The God Delusion. What I think will not be mentioned in the paperback edition is Prospect's review of the book, which begins by laying out the title, Dawkins the Dogmatist. Why, it asked, was he able to write such a bad book, and lays out the main lines of the argument they want to make. And it doesn't really resonate with what I want to say tonight very much, but the main concern they had simply was that the image presented of atheism was so dogmatic, it was very doubtful whether anybody would take it with great certainty. But let's just begin to look at the arguments and see where they take us. Dawkins, as I said, describes faith as a process of non-thinking. It is something that is infantile. It's a very interesting comment. We find a similar comment, of course, in Sigmund Freud. Freud, by the way, is not mentioned in The God Delusion. I think he needs to be, because in many ways Dawkins is developing Freud's ideas, and I think encounters the same difficulties as well. And Dawkins, of course, has a very simple analogy, which he gives in many of his writings to make this point. Believing in God is like believing in Santa Claus. It's the sort of thing that children do, but we can leave the crybaby phase behind and move on to maturity. Belief in God, belief in Santa Claus, childish beliefs, we should give them up in adulthood. It's a nice little analogy. Dawkins is very, very good at crafting analogies which make his point. But the analogy isn't valid. How many people do you know who, not believing in Father Christmas at the age of 6, do start believing him at the age of 18, or 35, or 50, or even, in the case of Anthony Flew, a recent mover away from atheism to belief in God in their 70s. People do give up believing in Santa Claus. I gave up believing in Santa Claus when I was 6, I think, but I let my parents think I kept on believing in it because I was aware it kind of had some advantages. And I used to think God was in the same category until I discovered God when I was 18. You will know people who discover God when they're 18, 35, 70. It's a non-valid analogy. But nevertheless, Dawkins does want to use it to try and get across this idea that faith in God is the sort of thing that mentally deficient people enjoy doing, either because they're simply fools or because they are both deluded and also deluding. It's turbocharged rhetoric, but is there a reality behind it? Dawkins is very clear, faith is about non-thinking. I go around England these days giving talks about Richard Dawkins, explaining roughly what he says in his books, and then providing rebuttals of all his main points. After one of these lectures in the south of England, where I simply said, here's what Dawkins says, here is, I fear, what the answers are, I was confronted by an extremely angry man, who came up to me and said, you have destroyed my life. I based my faith in what Richard Dawkins said, and you've shown it as a load of rubbish. I have nowhere to go. You have pulled the rug out from under my life. I am very, very angry with you. I believed in what Dawkins says, and now I cannot. I am drifting. Where do I go now? Well, I've no idea, I'm afraid. As I drove home that night, I think there were two thoughts in my mind as I reflected on the incident. Number one, how important beliefs are to people. Well, those beliefs are in God or not in God. We all base our lives on certain foundational beliefs that we hope are true, but actually can't be sure are true. I think what I've done that now is to show that there are some very fundamental questions about Dawkins' kind of a worldview which needed to be parried, needed to be examined much more closely. And secondly, I think the other thing that really occurred to me is that when someone is challenged about their beliefs, they do find it very, very disconcerting. We all have beliefs, even those of us who think we don't. And atheism, I want to say to you, is a belief system as much as Christianity or Buddhism or Islam. And I'll come back to that point later because I think it is very important. But I want to move on, if I may, and move on to a major theme we find in Dawkins' writings, especially in this book, The God Delusion. And he uses the word delusion in a sense I think we can all accept. It is a belief that we hold in the face of the evidence, knowing that the evidence is simply not acceptable. As opposed, for example, to the word illusion, which in the writings of Freud, again, Dawkins doesn't mention this, has a slightly different meaning. I don't think that's what Dawkins has in mind. So I think there are some very interesting points to be made here. Let's look at the intellectual roots of what Dawkins says. We're going back to the 19th century. We're going back to Ludwig Feuerbach about the year 1841. Feuerbach basically argued like this. There is no God. But people believe in God, which is rather interesting because there isn't one. Therefore, there has to be a natural explanation of why people should believe in God. And Feuerbach develops this hugely influential idea that, in effect, we fashion our worldviews, we fashion our religious ideas to suit our longings. In other words, we long that certain things should be true, they aren't, but we make them to be true. So, in effect, our religious views tell us a lot about what we would like to be the case. There is no God, but we invent God because we need God to get through life. It's a consoling delusion. And again, many of you will know that Karl Marx develops the idea by arguing that this illusion results from social pressures and Sigmund Freud from internal mental pressures, a very influential approach. But there are some issues we want to look at. Number one, Feuerbach, though Freud follows him in this, basically argues that religion is a wish fulfillment. That this is the dreamlike situation This is what we would like to be the case, even though it's not. And therefore, in effect, we invent God. Now, let's just look at that closely. It's certainly true that nothing exists because I wanted to. It'd be awfully nice if I wished there to be a pile of $50 bills here, and I can wish away, but I can tell you it's not going to happen. Wishing does not make things happen. But you just think about this. Does wishing something to be so mean it cannot be so? For example, you can hear my voice getting rather dry, and I might say, wouldn't it be really rather nice if there were some water to hand so that I could do something about my throat? The point's simple. I want something. It has no bearing on whether it's there or not there. And that's an extremely important point to make against Feuerbach. But I think the really interesting thing is this. If Feuerbach is right, and I think there is a big question mark about that, then it works just as well as argument for atheism as for Christianity. We make our religious views correspond to what we want to be true. Feuerbach says people want to believe in God because they're sad people who are no hopers, and God kind of keeps them going in the dark moments of life. But equally, those of you who are cultural historians will know that the fundamental shift in Western culture from about 1780 onwards was we don't want there to be a God because if there is no God, we can do what we like. And therefore, we are liberated. We can do what we please. You think of Dostoevsky, a very famous quote he makes in his novel The Possessed, where he imagines one of his characters saying, if there is a God, I've got to do what God wants, but if there is no God, I am free to do what I please. And that's been a very fundamental motivation in Western thought. I don't think this takes us very far. If it explains Christianity, it explains atheism as well. And therefore, I don't really think it has very much to say to us. Let's move on and look at something more interesting. One of the themes that Dawkins develops throughout his works is the idea that God is a virus of the mind. Now, it's a very potent image. How many viruses do you know that are nice? You think about that. Viruses are things that screw up computers, that mess up your health. They are things that infect you. They cause chaos. And in many ways, what Dawkins is arguing is that people do not believe in God because they have rationally thought this through, but because in some way they've been infected by a very contagious, very effective virus, and they gain this from their environment or from other people who believe in God. It's an intriguing view, but it's pseudoscience. I would say pseudoscience of the worst possible order. Let's just look at this belief very carefully. First of all, why do people believe that there are viruses that cause certain diseases? Answer, because one, the experimental evidence demands this is so. There is no other way of explaining things. Number two, because you can see these viruses and determine their structure and their mode of transmission, and hence, most importantly, how you might be able to block them in certain ways within the human immunosystem. In other words, the science is there. There is no science for this idea of anything being a virus of the mind. I could show you, if I wanted to, some very elegant pictures of the tobacco mosaic virus, lots of other things, and you might be very intrigued, although actually they aren't very elegant at all, but at least you can see them. No one has ever seen a virus of the mind. So let's just press the point further. Is Dawkins saying that all ideas are viruses of the mind, or just the ones he doesn't like? It's a good question, because, of course, scientifically, as many have pointed out, there is no way of making a distinction. The way in which ideas spread in populations bears no relation to whether they are good or bad ideas, whether they are right or wrong. And in fact, Dawkins is left in a very difficult situation because he's not able to explain why it is we have to say these ideas are viruses and these ideas are just, well, ideas. And in the end, of course, Dawkins makes a subjective judgment that there are certain ideas, including, of course, primarily belief in God, which are so clearly viruses, whereas other ideas, like atheism, are so obviously right, they require no explanation at all. Basically, it's simply a subjective criterion, which is, I think, without any evidential foundation. So again, I don't think this idea really carries us very far. And looking at the way in which Dawkins uses this idea in the God delusion, I think he knows that as well. But let's move on, if we may, because there are so many other things I want to cover. And I want to move on to the whole interface of science and religion. And one of the dominant themes of Dawkins' writings, it's certainly there in the God delusion, but you find it in the Devil's Chapter, in fact you find it right in his earlier works as well, is that science disproves God. Real scientists, with the word real underlined, are atheists. Now this view, I have to say, has prompted amusement amongst scientists back in England, who argue that there is no evidence for this at all. That in fact, the situation is much more complex than this. But because it's such a core assumption underlying Dawkins' approach, we need to look at it in more detail. Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, was published this year, as were two other very interesting books. Paul Davis' book, The Goldilocks Enigma, and Francis Collins' book, The Language of God. Each of those, Dawkins, Davis, Collins, are leading scientists. And it does nobody any good to suggest that any of those three is not. Yet those three books take very different positions. I've described to you roughly what Dawkins says. Paul Davis says that, in effect, the anthropic effects he observes, his so-called fine-tuning, suggests to him there's some kind of intelligence there within the universe, but he doesn't want to call it the Christian God or anything like that. He wants to be nuanced about what this is. Francis Collins, who's director of the Human Genome Project, argues that belief in God is perfectly consistent with what you observe in the world, and in his case especially, in the process of biological evolution. Am I to say that Davis and Collins are fools, are mad, are bad, because they take such a different angle on this to Dawkins? Dawkins may think they are, but I want to put it to you that we need a reality check here. And the reality is that there are many scientists who are religious believers. And that fact does cause him some difficulties. It's an empirical observation. Back in Oxford, I know so many scientists who are Christians and so many who are atheists who will simply say, well, of course, it's perfectly possible to be a scientist and a Christian, even though we personally are atheists. So I think there's a real need to ask what's going on here. Now, Dawkins has a rather interesting line of argument, which I don't think is entirely to his credit. He argues that scientists who are interested in God are members of the Neville Chamberlain School of Science. For those of you who don't know British history, and there's no reason why you should, Neville Chamberlain was the British Prime Minister who in the year 1938 thought he had persuaded Hitler not to go to war. And he came back waving a piece of paper saying, peace in our time. And the name of his policy was appeasement. The analogy Dawkins is suggesting is that people like Francis Collins and others, he singles out Michael Roos, a very good philosopher at the University of Florida for particular mention, are Neville Chamberlains because they appease religious people. So religious people are like Hitler, and these scientists are like Neville Chamberlain, who appeased them. Now, I'm sure some atheists will stand up and say, amen, give it to them, brother. In a rather nice way to Dawkins' rather fundamentalist atheist preaching. But I think most of you will be appalled by this. A, it just doesn't resonate with the facts. and B, this simplistic designation of people who believe in God as like Hitler. I mean, it's just bizarre. I think some very serious questions do need to be asked about that. But anyway, let's look at the arguments and just set these prejudicial things to one side. Science disproves God. Well, let's look immediately at a counter-proposal. Let's look at Stephen Jay Gould's proposals, which is set out in many places, but especially in a paper of 1992. And basically what Gould is doing is engaging with this argument that in some way science, and above all Darwinian evolution, is atheistic. And he argues like this. To say it for the umpteenth millionth time, there is no way that science, by its legitimate methods, can judge whether there is a God or God's involvement in the natural world. We don't say it's right, we don't say it's wrong, we simply say we cannot comment on it as scientists. It lies beyond the scientific method. I think that's right. Dawkins does not. Dawkins says in the God Delusion, I cannot believe that Gould meant what he said. But I think Gould did. I think he knew exactly what he meant, and that he's actually right about this. And Gould goes further, as many of you will know. He then lists all the evolutionary biologists he can think of. Here's a pile here. These are humanists and atheists. Here's a pile here. They believe in God. My goodness, they're about the same size. And Gould then says, either half my colleagues are absolutely stupid, or else evolution is compatible with conventional religious belief and equally compatible with atheism. The point he's making, I think, is known to any philosopher of science, namely that the natural order imposes upon you no ideology at all. You can interpret nature in a Christian way. You can interpret nature in an atheist way, but nature itself does not impose either of those upon you. The science does not lead you to atheism or to faith. But you can bring your atheism or your faith to science and make it resonate with what you find there. So again, I think a very important point to be made there. And the third point, I think, does need also to be made. And it's this. Are there limits to science? Now, you heard what Gould was saying. He was, in effect, saying there seems to be the legitimate application of scientific method, and then there is, by implication, the illegitimate application where you push it too far. So the question is, are there limits to what science can tell us? Dawkins says there are limits, but it's only because at this moment in time we can't answer certain questions. With the passage of time, science will explain everything, and therefore it is omnicompetent. That's a very interesting line of argument. But there are alternatives. I've mentioned Stephen Jay Gould. Other prominent British scientists say something very different. Let's look at Sir Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for his work on the human immune system. In a book he published in 1986 called The Limits of Science, very interesting title, Medawar argued that science, in principle, had no limits when engaging the material world. But when it came to asking deeper questions of meaning and purpose, and he singles out what he calls the ultimate questions raised by Karl Popper. Why are we here? What is the purpose of life? Then science really cannot answer those questions. But he then makes a very important point. He says, against dogmatic materialists, we must insist that these are genuine questions, not pseudo-questions asked by simpletons and only answered by charlatans. The point he's trying to make is these are real questions which people ask and are looking for answers. And therefore, if the sciences cannot answer them, we must look for answers elsewhere. And Medawar says we must look to metaphysics and religion for answers to those questions. That is most emphatically not the answer that Dawkins gives. But I want to make one point very, very clearly. Dawkins does not speak for science as a whole. He is a voice, a rather shrill voice, at one end of a spectrum. There are many other positions on that spectrum that need to be listened to and listened to with great seriousness. I've mentioned some of them tonight. And this simplistic mantra, real scientists are atheists. I mean, real only in the sense that I think that they agree with Dawkins. But I want to move on, if I may, because time is running out. And I want to look at what I think is one of the major themes in the God delusion, and that is that religion leads to violence. It's a very important point. And certainly when I was an atheist myself, growing up in Northern Ireland, that was a major element in my thinking. I saw the violence between Protestant and Catholic in Northern Ireland, and that seemed to resonate with this rather simplistic worldview I had, that religion was bad and evil, and sweeping it away would deal with the problems of the world. I want to make a criticism of Dawkins now, and it's a very serious criticism. Dawkins does not adequately distinguish between eradicating religious belief and eradicating religious people. And I would want to argue that his book could lead to the stigmatization of individual faith groups. And I would say, having read that book very carefully, above all Jews, Dawkins is extremely abusive about certain religious groups, particularly Judaism, in that book. And I do not think he adequately distinguishes between critique of religion and encouraging critique of a people group. So I want to make that point very, very boldly, because I think it is an important point to make. But let's begin by looking at this general point. Religion leads to violence. It does. I think that's a very obvious point. And I think that all of us here tonight will know of examples of religious violence, which basically we all deeply regret and wish had not happened. One of Dawkins' rhetorical techniques is to present the pathological as if it is normal. Yes, there are people who want to use violence to advance religious ends, but they do not speak for religious people as a whole at all. I'm a Christian. My role model is Jesus. Now, Dawkins has serious problems with this. He wants to criticize Jesus, but there isn't actually very much he can criticize him for. He criticizes him for his bad family values. He's rude to his mother. Well, that settles it. But you think of the ethic of non-violence that Jesus advocated. Can you point to a single point in the gospel where Jesus either allows violence to happen, advocates it, or anything like that? The whole point of the New Testament is that Jesus receives violence. Violence is done to him. He does it to no one. You think of an incident that happened here in the United States about 10 days ago, that ghastly incident at the Amish school. The Amish are radical followers of Jesus. Did you hear cries for violent revenge against the killer's family? No. You heard calls for forgiveness. If Dawkins were really against violence, he'd be endorsing that. The problem is he's against religion, and hence has real problems in the kind of ethic I've just been describing. But let's move on and look at the other side of this particular argument. Dawkins is absolutely clear. Atheists would never do violence. And if they did, they would never do it in the name of atheism. I want to say to you, somebody is living in La La Land. The history of the Soviet Union in the 20th century. As you will all know, when people would not voluntarily give up on religion in the Soviet Union, the world's first atheistic state, the firing squads were sent in to help things along. The statistics suggest that between 1918 and 1941, more than 90% of Soviet churches were bulldozed or dynamited, and more than 90% of Soviet priests were eliminated. Dawkins just doesn't engage with this. He airbrushes it out of his picture. I just want to say to you that, if any atheist here tonight, that the whole debate about violence and religion isn't helped by being in denial about atheist violence. We need to all face up to violence within our constituencies and ask, what can be done to make the world a safer place? But pretending that one particular group does not commit violence is simply running away from the problem, not doing anything to solve it. And the real issue, I think, is this. It's not to do with religion or indeed anti-religion. There seems to be something about human nature that means that when we really, really value something and think it is of transcendent importance, that we, A, are inspired to do some very good things by it, but also may do some bad things as well. Let me give you an example. I studied chemistry at Oxford many, many years ago, and one of the standard textbooks there was Fieser and Fieser, the Principles of Organic Reaction Mechanisms. It sounds dull, and I can tell you it lived up to expectations. But it was written by a husband and wife team, Louis Fieser, professor of chemistry at Harvard University. Professor Fieser invented the synthesis of the blood's anticoagulating factor. If you're a hemophiliac, you owe a lot to him. And the synthesis of lots of steroids. Great things. He also invented something else, which Harvard don't like talking about. In the year 1942, he invented something called napalm. Now, napalm was one of the earliest weapons of mass destruction. It was used to burn people alive. And for those of you who know the history of the Second World War, particularly the firebombing of Tokyo before, it's already in early 1945, there's some very nasty things going on there. Fieser did some wonderful things and some awful things. But I wouldn't want to say we stopped doing science because Fieser did some very bad things. I think if you're deadly realistic and say we need to encourage the things that are good and try to cut down on the things that are bad. I think that's really the issue here. So let's move on and ask, supposing Dawkins were to get his wish and religion were to be eliminated from the face of this earth. I don't see how that can be done, by the way, without violence and injustice. But we can leave that for the moment. Suppose there were no religion. Would that mean the end of violence? If you're a sociologist or anthropologist, you say, of course not. Because other social demarcators will come to the fore, and if we don't fight about religion, we'll fight about something else instead. It will be tribal, it will be economic, it will be racial, it will be you add to it. But basically, human nature, human beings have this remarkable ability to transcendentalize divisions. In other words, if it's not divine, you make it function as if it were divine. You simply elevate something else to this supreme position and you use that as a basis for defining people groups and encouraging conflict. Let me give you an example from 1792. Very famous example. We're in the French Revolution, began quite nicely, got very nasty, the Reign of Terror. In its first phase, the French Revolution was deist, a sort of sanitized version of God. In this phase, it was really turning into quite an atheist phase before eventually it would fade away altogether. Madame Roland was brought to the guillotine on trumped-up charges. And as she was being led to the guillotine in the Place de la Révolution, she pointed to the Statue of Liberty erected in that square, and she spoke these words, "Liberty, what crimes are committed in your name." That's a very powerful statement. It's just making the point that with God eliminated, something else had to be given all important significance. In this case, the idea of liberty, equality, fraternity. And these, in effect, became almost like divinities. And they simply led to violence in their own way. Yes, I have no doubt that religion can lead to violence. And those who believe in God need to work on this one. There is a need for reformation, as there is a need for the reformation of atheism as well. I end by making one point, and that is to do with cultural changes in North America. If I've been talking 50 years ago, I've been talking to a modernist worldview. The thing that goes back to the Enlightenment, that elevates reason to supreme importance. There is one way of doing and thinking. One way is right, all others are wrong. But now we're in a postmodern period where there is this sense that there are many positions on a spectrum of possibilities, and they all need to be treated with respect. Why? Because modernism was seen to be oppressive. There is only one way. And if you don't follow that one way, you are mad or you're bad. And postmodernism represents a reaction against that. As I read Dawkins, he seems terribly modern. He elevates rationality to this position of great importance. But the sociologist of knowledge will tell you that there are many rationalities throughout human history, even today. We cannot point to one and say that's it, let alone Western rationalities, when there are so many other possibilities. I think there's a very interesting question here about Dawkins' philosophical foundations, which seem to me to belong to a period that has long gone past. Dawkins, I think, is a scientific positivist of the 1890s, and very often he's described as a 19th century thinker, and I think that might actually be right. We'll have time for lots of questions later, but I just make one point in ending. I am absolutely sure, on reading Dawkins' book, that there are many people who are deluded about God. But my conclusion on reading that book was that those who are deluded about God might not only be on the religious side of the divide. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Alistair. You have a PhD in molecular biophysics, and I think there are other people here who are also trained in the sciences who can come to you as peers and ask questions. And then there are people like me, who all I can really say is that I've watched Star Trek for the last 30 years, and it's got me really interested in science. Makes me want to read journals and things like that. So it's a privilege to pick your brain. And I also want to start with one clarification, and it's the one that Richard Dawkins himself has been making. He's in the country right now. I saw him on the Colbert Report the other night, and he is finding it necessary in America to say to audiences that he is not the guy in the wheelchair who can't speak. That's Stephen Hawking, the physicist. Richard Dawkins is a biologist. So I'm just curious. Anybody here who thought we were talking about? Okay, there we go. There's one or two. I once read something. The astrophysicist Robert Jastrow said that when a scientist writes about religion, his colleagues assume he's either over the hill or going bonkers. So, I mean, as someone who started out in the sciences and then moved to the discipline of theology, give us a little bit of your story of, you know, why you went bonkers.
Well, I studied sciences at high school, and I really loved them. I thought they were the most wonderful thing ever. And I still do. I mean, I still have the greatest regard for science. I keep up with my reading, which is very, very important. I think that what changed for me, I think, really was my understanding of them, of their implications. And when I was at high school, when you're 16, everything is black and white, it's wonderfully simple. And in my wonderfully simple world, you know, there were scientific people and there were idiots. And it was obvious to me that that science had disproved religion, and that therefore those who were religious were really quite weird people. Right. And I have to say that growing up in Northern Ireland wasn't really very helpful. I went to church once in a country church out in Northern Ireland, and we were saying the Athanasian Creed. I don't know if you know this. It's rather tedious. I don't know why we said it, but I was standing next to an old farmer. And we said, I think if I got the right words right, the Father incomprehensible, the Son incomprehensible, the Holy Ghost incomprehensible. And this man said the whole damn thing's incomprehensible. that's where I was, you know, it was just right. I think more seriously, though, I think I was very, very clear that the science has just removed conceptual space for God. Right. There was no need for it. I mean, I could not see what the motivation for being a Christian was. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, brought up in Northern Ireland, religion was about being forced to do certain things that were, in my view, pointless and tedious, and also not being allowed to do certain things that I thought looked rather more interesting. Yes. So, I just couldn't see the point.
Right, right. Yeah, I was just reading about Mother Teresa, and I was really surprised to read. She was someone who had what she describes the dark night of the soul. That is, she lived with crippling doubt. So even as she was serving the poor, she often had just despairing doubts, thoughts that, is this real? Am I imagining God? Am I imagining all this? And that's something she lived with. It's funny because when I read this book, The Dawkins Delusion, I was struck by the fact that it seems that Dawkins has absolutely no doubts in terms of, he writes with virtual certainty. And I noticed that just in the, not only Dawkins, but if you read Sam Harris, I think there's a similar sort of just absolute certainty that you only really find, I think, with fundamentalists. I was on the jacket of the book. When I first picked it up, I just couldn't believe this, but this was from the magician Penn Jillette, who basically said, if this book doesn't change the world, we're all screwed. That's just a remarkable sense of how right we are, how important this is. So I think before we talk about him directly, I'd like to start with you and say, is there doubt in your faith? And does that play a role in how you think through these questions as an apologist?
Well, I think any worldview goes beyond the available evidence. Whatever you're saying, whatever you say is meaningful, whether you believe in democracy or Christianity or atheism, actually you're going beyond the available evidence.
Right.
And I think that means that you are making statements that actually in the end cannot be proven to be true. You take them on trust because you believe they are rational, you believe that they are right, but you cannot prove that that is so. Mm. And therefore, of course I have doubts. There are moments when I wonder, do I really, is this really as right as I believe it to be so? And therefore I'm a very self-critical person, always want to, to read Dawkins and people like him and say, we've got to listen to what they say. I don't see a similar openness on the other side, I have to say. Dawkins does make statements with great rhetorical confidence, but very often the rhetorical confidence masks poor arguments and sometimes, frankly, abuse of evidence. Mm. So one of the things I found myself doing actually in reading that book was trying to work out who the intended readership was. And I think it's exactly the person, the magician guy who you quoted. It is atheists who need their faith being bolstered and reassured. If atheism is right, we shouldn't be here. America should have become secular 40 years ago. Why is it not so? Why is there this great resurgence of religion throughout the world and even in all places of Western Europe, which is the most godless place on earth? And so, there's this huge disparity between the theory and the evidence. I mean, if you take Michael Shermer, for example, who I respect greatly, he's president of the Skeptic Society, edits Skeptic magazine, and he is very, very critical of religion, but he's also a very honest person. And he simply makes the point that God is back with a vengeance. And he's also very, very clear, and I think this is very, very significant, that while religion has caused much violence, it has also caused much good. And that view is simply airbrushed out of Dawkins' rather flimsy account of things. I think intellectually it's simply lacking a fairness and objectivity, which I think we expect in 400 pages of analysis.
Right, right. Yeah, one of the things, let's move on and talk about this book. One of the things that, I have four sons, and my 13-year-old has helped me discover YouTube. And I think I'm watching things that are probably illegal, that I'm not supposed to know about. So I'm being honest here, right? But I watched Dawkins' BBC documentary, The Root of All Evil, on YouTube. So it was broken up in little segments, but I wanted... It's a documentary about religion, The Root of All Evil. And I think this book comes out of that work, if I'm correct, in which it seems to me that the strategy was to find the absolute craziest people you could lay your hands on. And, it reminded me a little bit of Roger and Me kind of approach. Just find people who love to kill rabbits, and this will sort of illustrate your point. Now, you were interviewed, weren't you, as part of that documentary?
Yes, but I
couldn't find you on YouTube.
No.
What happened?
What happened was Dawkins put to me all the major themes of the TV program, and I simply gave a rebuttal of each of them in a very simple way. In fact, rather like I've been doing tonight. It was cut. Now, I don't know what that says to you about fairness and objectivity. The qualities I think I find lacking in that program. And for those of you who are atheists, I mean, why on earth do you do this sort of thing when it simply persuades people that you cannot take religious people seriously? I mean, it's a serious problem for you. I mean, as it happens, I will have a comeback because I shall be publishing a book in February in which I basically will be taking this book to pieces and will be making the point that that I was censored in this documentary because my views didn't resonate with what the program makers wanted. But let me give you an example. I mentioned Adolf Hitler earlier. There's Adolf Hitler. Therefore, all Germans are evil and bad. The logic's impeccable, isn't it? Or do you just sense that actually the argument might be more complicated than that? I mean, one of the things that really puzzles me is, again, I have many, many friends who are atheists, and they're appalled by this because it creates the impression that atheists are non-thinking people. Who really accept the most flimsy of arguments. And really, as I read that book, it really does say to me something very, very worrying about the contemporary intellectual state of atheism. Mm-hmm. And I think that if there are atheists here tonight, I think you'll probably want to say, please don't judge us by that book. I mean, we really don't buy into this simplistic thinking, religion evil, atheism good. It's just not that simple. So we can make that point, I think, very, very clearly.
Right. Well, I'd like to go to one of the key ideas, the idea of the meme. And this, I think, it comes from genetics and the neo-Darwinian synthesis. Could you just, because I think there are probably a number of people who haven't read Dawkins here, probably many who have, but could you just say a few words about what a gene is, and what Dawkins is proposing with the idea of the meme?
Well, the gene, very, very simply, is a kind of means of transmitting biological information from one generation to another. So in effect, any developments that take place in one generation are passed on to another. It's a way of encoding genetic information. And Dawkins argues, even as early as The Selfish Gene, which was his first book published back in 1976, that there may be an analogy here between biological development and cultural development. And he invents this word meme, M-E-M-E. He derives it from the Greek word mimesis, meaning imitation. And he argues that there's a parallel between biological evolution and cultural evolution, between biology and ideas. And the meme, basically, is something that enables ideas to be transmitted. And Dawkins argues that the most important of these is the idea of God. So there is a meme for God. And these memes spread these ideas in culture, both laterally and diachronically. And so the basic point he's trying to make is that we can explain the origins of ideas like God with reference to these things called memes. And in The Selfish Gene, he says we can imagine these things leaping from mind to mind. And so he really is trying to describe how ideas spread. It's a bit like the virus of the mind, but a slightly different idea.
Right. I'm going to ask you, last night we were in Berkeley. We did this same venue, an open forum, over in Berkeley at the Gaia Theater. And, you know, Berkeley is the only town I know of in the country where you actually have Nobel laureate parking, which is pretty cool. You just saw, not that I use it. yet. There was just a Nobel Prizes awarded to scientists there, and it had to do with the certainty now of being able to map background radiation. And there was a long time there where scientists said, you know, the universe is in a cosmologists said that the universe is in a steady state. And now, you know, we know for a fair amount of certainty that we can see evidence of the Big Bang. I read something in the New York Times. John Noble Wilford wrote that cosmologists have changed their minds so many times now about the beginning of the universe that the discipline is jokingly referred to as cosmetology. but now, I mean, now there's been real, I mean, in what, 20 years now, real advance to consensus around the Big Bang. Now, do you think, as a theologian, I'm asking you now, not just as a scientist, but as a theologian, do you think this creates some openness to thinking about the idea of creation?
Well, I think if you look at the way in which this has developed, certainly if you look at, for example, the steady state theory, I mean, that could be reconciled with Christianity, but it was not obviously resonant with the Christian idea of creation. And certainly the idea of the Big Bang actually makes an awful lot more sense from a Christian point of view. But it's very interesting to note that actually many physicists were very resistant to this whole idea of the Big Bang because it did seem to be a religious idea. And so you have this rather paradoxical idea that anxiety that this might be seen as endorsing Christianity was actually a significant factor in holding it back. Mm. But I think more generally, I mean, again, I go back to Paul Davis' very interesting book, The Goldilocks Enigma. And some of you may be wondering what the Goldilocks Enigma actually is. Now, for those of you who know the story of Goldilocks, there are these three bowls of porridge. If you taste one, it's too hot. Next one, too cold. Next one, just right. And the Goldilocks Enigma is the universe seems to be just right for the emergence of life. And in that book, Paul Davis is basically trying to lay out what the science is and then ask what the metaphysics are. In other words, does this point to the existence of a God or not? And his answer is basically some kind of God, but not the kind of God that Christians believe in. So it's very interesting. But certainly what Davies is saying is this opens up some very interesting questions. And I certainly agree with him on that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier when you gave the sort of three examples of Davies and Dawkins, and then you also mentioned Francis Collins. I've just read his most recent book, The Language of God. And now this man, he's the director of the Human Genome Project. And in it, he particularly looks at evolution and says, you know, look, this is not just a theory. But as a Christian, he writes and sort of lays out his compatibility model for his Christian worldview and what we know about evolution. And he calls that model biologos. And I'm just curious, do you have your own sort of compatibility model, or could you just... I know there are people who will be curious about that. I'd like to know your thinking.
Well, I think that obviously Christians have had various viewpoints on this, but certainly what Francis Collins is arguing is that as a scientist, he just sees evolution happening, and it makes perfect sense to him. And he also sees that as resonating with his particular reading of not just the book of Genesis, but also the Christian understanding of God in general. And for Francis Collins, evolution really is the process by which God brings things to the point at which he wishes them to be.
Right.
And so I would echo that. I can see that working perfectly well. And therefore, it does raise some very interesting questions. I mean, for example, again, we've been talking about Richard Dawkins. Very interesting, when Dawkins was commenting on the Pope's fairly recent suggestions that evolution actually was perfectly compatible with faith, Dawkins was very, very dismissive. He said, this is simply dishonest. I'd rather have an honest fundamentalist, you know, who said evolution is opposed to faith. And I thought, actually, Dawkins, who I thought wanted to advance evolution, might have actually welcomed papal endorsement. But no, he in effect used this as a way of saying, no, the Pope is being dishonest, because we all know that you cannot be a religious person and believe in evolution. Now, I think that is such a gross stereotyping that actually does need to be challenged. I mean, there are many Christian positions on this issue, and my personal position is that of Francis Collins, that these things are perfectly compatible.
Right. Now, you do a fair amount of debating. You were telling me earlier, you just were at the Oxford Union. Tell me about the debate you just did there.
Yes, we had a very interesting debate earlier this year between myself and Susan Blackmore. Susan Blackmore wrote a book, you may have come across it, called The Meme Machine. And basically, it's a development of Richard Dawkins' ideas. Takes them much further than Dawkins did, but we had a splendid argument of whether these memes explained religion and the meaning of life. And it was a very well-attended debate. But I don't think the audience were persuaded either that memes existed or that actually they explained very much. So it was a very interesting evening.
But now, you, when you debated Dawkins on the BBC, but this was a few weeks ago, right? I mean, that was just 10 minutes. Not a lot you can do on 10 minutes, even if it's fair and balanced. You still, that's not a lot of time. I mean, are there any plans for the two of you to have a more extensive debate?
No, not that I know of. I would very much like to, because I think that what Dawkins says in that book really does need to be challenged. And in the book, he closely says he's not really into debates. But I take the view that, you know, if you have strong views, you lay them before people and you debate them with other people so the audience can make an adjudication for themselves. And I would just, Dawkins is not here to make his case, but I would want to say that I find this book to be seriously inadequate in his representation of religious views. And I would also want to say I think it's rather simplistic in the way which he presents science. Now, if Dawkins were here, I would very much hope he'd want to debate me. And I'd very much like that debate to take place, because I think it's a very important debate, and it really needs to happen.
Yeah, I agree. One last thing, and then we'll open it up here, and that is just give a word about the book you and your wife. Now, your wife, Joanna, is she's a pastor, but she's also a neuropsychologist. Why, tell me why you wrote this book together, the response.
Well, we both read the book, The God Delusion, and in chapter 5, as you may know, there's a very interesting and very badly informed section on the possible psychological origins of religion. My wife studies psychology at Oxford. Her PhD is in neuropsychology, and she's recently started work as a lecturer in psychology of religion. And between the two of us, we really felt that there was just a need to rebut what was being said in this book. And therefore, we're writing a book together. In fact, the book is now written. Basically, we're going to call it The Dawkins Delusion. For the very simple reason that it is such a distorted view of what religion is and also what science says about religion that I think someone just needs to present an alternative perspective for the public to evaluate fairly.
Right. Thank you. Now, we have microphones. There's one over here to your right, and there's one over here to your left, and for those of you upstairs, there's one right in the center. So please make your way. If you've jotted down a question that you want to follow up, personal questions for Professor McGrath about Christian faith, the sciences,
or specifically about Richard Dawkins, or things that are happening in atheist circles right now. And we'll begin here on the right, over here. Yes, and speak. I'm going to ask you to please speak directly into the microphone. And I think you're going to need to raise that microphone a little bit, if you can, and speak directly in the mic. We'll start here.
Yeah, I was wondering, the rhetoric of Dawkins' debate is, I haven't read the book, but taking your word for it, is I guess extreme, as you characterize it. And I'm wondering if the extremeness of the rhetoric of that particular position is a reflection of a transition in the history of Western thought, where we're not so much operating under the metaphysical assumption that all things are material anymore, that we're now kind of moving back to a worldview that allows for the non-material in a way that it didn't 40, 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if that transition is part of what's being reflected in the shrillness of the rhetoric, whereas, as you recognize, lots and lots of Christians and lots of scientists and Christians are finding ways to coexist in ways that Dawkins doesn't want to allow, because he's just not up on the latest fact that the world seems to be allowing ideas to exist again in the ways that they didn't metaphysically 40, 50 years ago.
I see what you're saying. I think it's a very interesting question, and certainly his rhetoric is very aggressive. And the real difficulty I find with his rhetoric is that very often he will say something like, only a fool would say this, or any intelligent person would say this. And yet very often it's papering over the cracks in an evidentially deficient argument. And I would very much value less rhetoric and more evidence than actually the way he handles things. I think that, you know, when you read this book, I mean, it is a gross exaggeration, it's misrepresentation. It is very often there are only two options, this or this, when everybody knows there are many, many in between. And by, in effect, saying there's either this option which is sane, this option which is mad, it has to be this one. But of course, there are many others in between. And that is the point you're making, actually, that certainly in recent years there's been an explosion of interest in the science and religion field. And that is actually one of the most productive fields of inquiry in recent years. And Dawkins really regards this as just intellectual nonsense. How can science and religion talk to each other? They are locked in permanent warfare. And only one side can win, and of course it has to be science. And yet, you know, if you're a historian, and then, you know, one of the first things you learn, basically, is that this idea of a perennial warfare between science and religion is just a myth. Certainly it was so in the 1890s in England, but it hasn't been so elsewhere. I think really what Dawkins has to do is, in effect, talk things up in such a way that everyone who reads this book feels there is a cosmic conflict. Again, this quote on the back, if I can just read it to you, this point that was being made about, you know, if this book doesn't change the world, we're all screwed. Well, again, that is a hysterical example of this kind of polarization. And there are many other options. And it just seems to me that this book really doesn't help very much. It's a very polemical book. It doesn't really explore alternatives. And in effect, it simply offers us a bipolar alternative. Rational, anti-religious science, mad, evil religion. I just want to say that represents a hysterical attenuation of possibilities. Right. And there are other much more interesting ones that I think we need to be exploring, but unfortunately this book doesn't help us do that. So thank you for that.
Well, and you know, it seems to me, Alistair, that so much of so much of this is driven by just the history of, it's not just that science has in a vacuum sort of developed a kind of rhetoric. I mean, there is religious terror. I mean, there's been religion-based terrorism. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but religion's certainly a factor in it. There have been, in America particularly, there's been a lot of hostility to science as well. I mean, and I think there is a general popular conception that these two can't coexist. I think of Woody Allen's comment that, you know, between the Pope and air conditioning, I'll take air conditioning. You know, I mean, I think there's just, you know, this general sense that science is good for us and religion has caused a lot of problems. Right, let's go here to the left.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed a lot of the comments you had, and so I'm going to try instead focus on like one or two areas where I have some questions and maybe some disagreements. One of the themes that you stressed was sort of this notion that science and religion aren't in fundamental conflict because they're sort of, they deal with fundamentally different domains of knowledge, and sort of quoted the Gould, the things that Gould wrote with approval there. And it seems to me that there are certain areas where there are some tensions between the two, or at least potential tensions. And I'll throw out one that I think is very much linked in with the whole question of Darwinism, which I think, you know, one of the reasons it was so controversial historically was because it was seen as possibly impacting a lot of religious ideas we had about the world. And sort of the way, you know, just, and there were all these, you know, scientists and, you know, thinkers in the late 19th, early 20th century who believed that if you had sort of a naturalistic account of the origins of species, it would be very logical that there would be some corollary that somebody would come up with one day that would be a naturalistic account of the origin of cultures and the origin of religions, and that some brilliant new scientist would write a book entitled The Origin of Religions that would transform the human sciences in the same way in which the origin of species transformed the biological sciences. Now, I will concede that such a book has perhaps not yet been written, and that, you know, Freud and all the other people who tried to do so failed. But I wonder, you know, Are you saying that it's absolutely categorically impossible that anybody will ever write such a book, which seems, after all, something like that, seems like a natural corollary from the Darwinian project? Or alternatively, even if such a book were written, that it would have nothing to say whatsoever about the truth of religion one way or the other? That the origin of religion, if you could explain the origin of religion, that would not tell you one way or the other whether it's slightly more true or slightly less true.
Thank you. Well, that's a very rich question, and I think what I'll try and do is answer it, because I think many in the audience will be very interested in the question as well. You mentioned this noma, this business from Stephen Jay Gould, a non-overlapping magisteria, and I don't agree with that. In fact, one of the problems I have with Dawkins is he says, look, either there's Gould or there's me. You have science and religion in non-interactive mode. There's the science box, there's the religion box. That's Gould. And Dawkins says, no, for me, science does everything. If you read Francis Collins, he gives an alternative approach, which is partially overlapping. In other words, they're not identical, they're not totally different, but they are commenting on similar things. They interpenetrate each other. I think that's very important to say, because I think both Gould and Dawkins actually are wrong on this. I think that there are many different ways in which science and religion interact, but that they are not at war with each other. But there are tensions there. There's no doubt about that. And I wouldn't want to deny that there are tensions there. I think it's very important to explore what those tensions are and what gives rise to them. For example, there are tensions between Darwinism and Christianity, but those tensions are partly occasioned by social and political factors, which is why they're much more significant here in the United States than they are, for example, in the United Kingdom. But you made a good point, I think, about this quest for an ultimate explanation of religion. Am I saying there will never be one? Well, it's a very interesting question. And certainly, if you take Sigmund Freud, who I think is widely thought to have offered the most ambitious psychological explanation for the origin of religion, I think most psychologists since then would say we could never dream of replicating that, because we appreciate that things are even more complex than Freud thought. But I think a point I'd like to make might be helpful here. I mean, we now know much, much more about, for example, the neurochemistry, the neuropsychology of the brain. So, for example, we know an awful lot more about the physical processes by which we process information, the way in which we react to stimuli, and so on. But here's the point I want to make. I am looking at this white mug. If I'm able to offer you a much better account, of how I reckoned, and therefore is what Dawkins calls a delusion. So all I can say is that at this stage, I see no evidence for that. The question is open. I wouldn't want to rule out further discussions, but I would want to say that the very confident predictions of earlier generations that God would be explained away or God would cease to be a relevance actually really have not been shown to be true. That's where we are at the moment. We've got to keep this one open, but I think it's significant that that really hasn't been answered in that way. Right. Thank you.
Does that speak to your question? Did you want to follow up?
I agree with you that it certainly is a question that has not been answered adequately, and people like Freud or Frazier did not come up with an adequate explanation scientifically. I think my question, I agree with you that I think if you came up with something that described the neural wiring and why the neural wiring worked, and then you know the thought that you have from that, I wouldn't tell you anything about the truth of those thoughts. My question was a little bit more focused on if you could describe the history of you know where these ideas came from, and you could describe the history of how religion itself originated. I think the psychology, I'm skeptical that will ever tell you something. If you had a full account of human anthropology and the origin of cultures and the origin of religions, would that not tell you something that would be quite relevant to either the truth or falsity of various religions? The example would be like if you look at something like the origin of various cults. You know, we think that the question of the origin is quite important.
Yeah,
I think that's right. And certainly, one can give a good historical account, I think, of, for example, Dawkins talks about the so-called cargo cults of the South Pacific. Although I don't think they're quite as relevant as he thinks they are. But certainly, one of the things you'd want to say, I think, is that we do need to make a distinction between believing in God and the modes of religious expression that accompany that. And certainly, Dawkins really doesn't make that distinction very, very clear. And certainly, one of the points I'd want to make is that a leading theme of both the Old Testament and indeed the ministry of Jesus is a critique of existing forms of religion. In other words, there are these inherited ways of behaving or acting or living out a belief in God, and they are very, very critical of these. And I think that's a very important point, because very often we have this idea that if we can explain historically how certain religious practices came into being, well, that kind of way explains them away. What you see in the Old Testament and the New, actually, is a reformation of these things in the light of something that seemed to be beyond them, namely belief in God, and that gives a kind of basis for the regeneration and renewal of religion itself. So I think that it's very helpful to bring that into the equation as well.
But it seems to me, what I appreciate about what he's asking is that if Christianity is true, or if it's just authentic, then part of what has to always be taking place, there has to always be this openness. I think Augustine talked about the idea of God's word and God's world. That God speaks in both. And it seems to me that whether we're talking about the Big Bang or evolution or quantum mechanics, anything, any worldview that, to be taken seriously, I mean, it has to be open to what those have to say.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that's why the kind of approach I'd adopt to Christianity is a very engaging approach. That if Christianity is right, then it mandates an engagement with culture. It mandates an engagement with nature. And it is not a dismissive engagement. It's very much we are doing this because we believe that we are learning more about God by doing it. Again, just to give you a very simple point, many, many natural scientists are so because they're Christians. And they believe that to study nature is somehow to gain an enhanced appreciation of the wisdom of God. And so there's this very strong religious motivation for wanting to be scientists. And I would certainly want to say that a very important aspect of Christian discipleship is a willingness to engage critically and reflectively culture, science, and so on, and that we don't need to be afraid about doing that. I'd strongly endorse this active engagement approach.
But there's a lot of that happening. I mean, even in quantum theory, there's Capra, not the one who made It's a Wonderful Life, but the Buddhist,
yes.
Who says, you know, actually this really, you know, quantum mechanics really, really fits in with an Eastern worldview. I'm just curious, have you given much thought to that?
Yes, I read Capra and the Tao of physics and that sort of thing. And certainly what he does is, let me put this as kindly as I can, he angles quantum mechanics in a certain way so that it really accentuates certain aspects of Buddhism which he thinks might be interesting. But I think I'd want to say that actually quantum mechanics is so malleable that actually it can be used in an atheist, in a Buddhist, in a Taoist, in a Christian way. And that we're all going to find something there that we can agree with. Mm. And I think that for me, though I disagree with Capra, he is nonetheless asking a perfectly good question, which is, for example, if quantum mechanics is right, well, how does that impact with religious belief? And I would say it impacts with religious belief in a very significant way. If you look at quantum mechanics, it says, look, as a result of our interaction with the world, we realize that to do justice to the evidence, we have to think in very counterintuitive ways. We may not like doing it, but that's the way the evidence presses us. And again, if you're a Christian and thinking about God, you'll say, well, look, that's what the doctrine of the Trinity is really all about. It's saying to do justice to what we know about God, we end up thinking in rather counterintuitive ways. But we have to do justice to what we experience, what we know to be right. And in the end, the Trinity, if you like, is the outcome of that process of evidence-driven engagement.
Right. Go to the balcony. Sorry, you've been standing there all this time.
Hello. My question perhaps is not so abstract. First of all, I'd like to admit I'm a scientist, for better or worse. And I think a simple term in terms of
there's a 12-step group here. You've just admitted you're a scientist. And
I think in terms of science itself, you agree that we're basically in search for truth. And that's what we try to do, however it comes to us. I'd also like to admit, my wife has been a Christian for many years, and recently, 3 months ago, I became a Christian as well. It's on both sides here. So I think one of the things, for me, I think it was a leap of faith. I think ultimately that becomes what happens. But as a scientist myself, I think I don't care about the Big Bang or evolution, that type of thing, I think, doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things from me. But I think for one key question is, for example, the Immaculate Conception has been on my mind. For example, if a lady walked into our OB or whatever and said that she was pregnant with the Son of God, what would you do? As a scientist, you'd go, let's get these genes that we're talking about and see, okay, she's half Mary and half God, or is it someone else? I mean, you just don't know. So in terms of that, one, you may have the DNA of God, or you may have the DNA of, you know, Mary's boyfriend, or something like that. I don't know. I mean, it's a tough question, but that's what we could do in today's world in terms of trying to figure out with science what components this baby is part of. So I was, you know, I'm trying to be a Christian, trying to grow my faith as well. I was just wondering from your standpoint how you see that in terms of the Virgin Mary, the Immaculate Conception story, and how that relates to your faith. Because I'm sure a lot of scientists who are trying to, you know, explore Christianity have thought about this as well.
Right. I'm very happy to answer this question, but I need to try and clarify a bit. I mean, the idea of I'm not a Catholic. The idea of the Immaculate Conception actually...
I think it's the Virgin birth.
Right. The Immaculate Conception is a Catholic dogma about the birth of Mary. It's saying she was born without sin. And I personally don't really go along with that. I think you're probably talking about the Virgin
right,
birth.
That's good.
I think, you know, it is one of these areas where there's going to be a very interesting negotiation between science and faith. And certainly, I think, you know, what you read about in Matthew's Gospel, for example, is saying there is something very, very special, very, very different about this infant Jesus who's going to be born into the world. And it's all to do with this whole question of the identity of who Jesus is. And if he is to be the savior of the world, then he needs to be distinct from the problem. In other words, he's not part of the problem, he's a solution. And certainly traditional Christian theology has seen the idea of the virgin birth as being about, in effect, saying Jesus did not share the common human condition of sin. Therefore, he had the capacity to redeem humanity. Now, I personally think that we can conceptualize that in a number of ways. But I think that the question you were really asking is to do with the technicalities of DNA. And I would have to say on this one, I'm not really quite sure where we go on this. And I share your sense of puzzlement here. I think there are a whole range of areas where we're going to have to say we're not really quite sure how this works, or we may have to say that science can't really help us very much here. And I don't personally have a huge difficulty with that, because I was hinting earlier that I'm very open to this idea of science having its limits. But certainly, you're saying towards the beginning that for you, evolution and the Big Bang weren't that big deals. I think for me, they probably are quite big deals. And certainly that's an area of science that I think probably we do need to talk about, as well as the very interesting question you've raised.
Right. But it's interesting, again, back to my television viewing as a source of science. But, in Star Wars, it starts with Anakin having midichlorians. You know, there's something that can be sort of observed going on. But for Christians, in a sense, we really begin with this reality that Jesus was raised from the dead. And from that, we really sort of look back at all these other claims that are mysteries. And yet it's that fact that I think drives so much of what
we believe. That's right. And certainly, I was talking to a very prominent German theologian about a year ago, a man called Jürgen Moltmann. And he's very, very interesting. He said to me, "I believe in God because of Jesus." And I thought about that. I thought about that very hard. And I see what he means. What he meant was he found something so compelling about Jesus that in effect, he said, "Look, this guy's got something and I trust him. And therefore, I'm going to believe in God as a result." Now, in fact, in the end, he came to a much more fully orbed Christian faith. But what was interesting was the way in to believing in God was not arguments about God's existence, but simply, there's this guy, Jesus, and there's something very, very special about him. And that was actually the thing that really got him going on that.
You know, as I look at the clock, I'm going to have to offer an apology to those of you standing at the mic. There's just no way I think we're going to be able to get to all of your questions. What I'd like to say is that we're going to have time for a book signing, and I'm sure Professor McGrath would love to meet you and hopefully could give you a quick response to any questions.
Yes, I'm very happy to meet with people and answer questions afterwards. Yeah. We haven't got time for it now.
I do want to say just a few things before people leave, and that is just to say that with your parking. We've had events here where you have to have parking validated. I just want to let you know you don't have to do that. If you've ever been to City Church, basically if you parked in the lot across the street, all you really need to do is go down to the lowest level and you'll see a booth there, and there's someone there who will give you the ticket you need to exit the parking lot. That's all you need to do. I want to close this out. And actually, Alistair, I want to close by just asking you one last question. And it has to do, we've talked about, what we know through science, and then you keep talking about faith. And I what's coming because I asked you this last night, same question. But there's an episode of Star Trek where Mr. Worf realizes that he thinks he's met the Klingon Messiah, and he finds out he's a fraud. And his life is just destroyed because, it was disproved. And so he comes alongside Mr. Data, who's an android, and he tells him his problem. And Mr. Data says this. He says, "Well, the same thing happened to me when the man who built me, Dr. Ninian Sung, when he told me that I was nothing but, that I was an android and I was nothing but basically sub-processors." He said, "And I chose to believe, against reason, against the evidence, I chose to believe that I was more than sub-processors." And Mr. Worf said, "Well, how did you do that?" And Data sort of, cocked his head and said, "I made a leap of faith. And I as much as I love Star Trek, I hated that because it implied that faith really required you to sort of believe against the evidence. What would you say to someone here who really had questions about, you know, how can I possibly believe this? What can you say to them about the nature of faith?
Well, I think Richard Dawkins would say faith is belief in the teeth of the evidence. In other words, it's about running away from things. But I think what I want to say is this. I mean, for me, faith is not something that goes against the evidence. It's simply something that goes beyond it. Hmm. In other words, the evidence points you in certain directions and says, look, it's like a horizon. There's some mountains there. And you can see the mountains, but actually beyond them there's something else. And it's really saying, look, what the evidence is saying to us, there is another country. There is something beyond the realms of experience. It's not irrational. It's actually just one step beyond what reason can disclose. And I think it's about really just going beyond the horizon of the limits of reason, the limits of evidence. And for me, I think I would say that my faith in many ways was very, very rational. It was saying, look, everything would make sense. What I did was I stepped into a Christian worldview and said, look, if Christianity were right, this makes an awful lot of sense of things. And there's a quote from C.S. Lewis I love. I'll tell you what it is. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen. Not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And Christianity has this immense explanatory fecundity. It's very, very rich. Mm-hmm. And you can see the world in a completely new light that makes sense. And yet it's far more than anything else will give. So it's not a leap of faith in the sense of, you know, this is mad, this is stupid. It's much more saying, look, I am on the edge of the promised land. I can see it. It's there in the distance. I know it's there. I'm just going to take one extra step. And then I know that that step's going to confirm what I believe to be true. And so I'm in this very interesting situation of having taken the extra step and from that side being able to look back and said, I made a wise choice. It's a very interesting question. You know,
was it that you just found coherent ideas there?
Well, the ideas are coherent, but of course it's far more than that.
Right.
It's not just, you know, Christianity is about believing in certain ideas. It's about encountering a personal reality that utterly transforms you. And that's just so important. It's not simply ideas as if those were abstract things. It's about encountering God as a living reality who is able to actually dynamically transform your life, including the way you think. And for me, that is why Christianity is so wonderful. It makes sense. But also utterly changes us and gives us hope. And that seems to me to be an immensely important thing we need in these rather dark times.
We will, in just a few minutes, if you wish, we will have copies of Dawkins' God, Genes, Memes, and the Meaning of Life available in the Goal Room, just adjacent. Alistair McGrath, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.